told me that her niece Parker Yeo heard the most sensational tidbit from Teddy Lim. Apparently, Nikki's all set to marry that girl next month. Instead of a grand wedding here, they are getting married in California on a beach. Can you imagine?
Hiya! What a disgrace!
Poor Su Yi. And poor Eleanor. What a loss of face. All her efforts to position Nikki as the most favored grandson have been dashed.
Remember, Mummy, ho hoi say ya.
Cantonese for don't put a curse of death, meaning don't sabotage the situation.
Don't say anything.
Don't worry, I won't say a thing to Su Yi,
Lillian May promised. She was glad to be here at Tyersal Park at last, in this oasis of splendor far removed from the garish New Year kitsch that adorned the rest of the island. To Lillian, there was this sense of being in an enchanted time warp the moment she passed through the front door. It was a house that adhered only to the traditions decreed by its exacting chatelaine, transforming for the festive season in its own subtle ways. The white phalaenopsis orchids that usually greeted visitors on the ancient stone table in the foyer were replaced by a towering arrangement of pink peonies. Upstairs in the drawing room, a 20-foot-long calligraphy scroll bearing a New Year poem by Shu Zimo, composed in tribute to Sui's late husband, Sir James Young, would be unfurled against the silver and lapis-inlaid wall. And the white voile curtains that usually flapped against the veranda doors would be swapped for watered silk panels in the palest shimmering rose. In the sun-soaked conservatory, the New Year tea ritual was just beginning. Su Yi, resplendent in a high-necked turquoise silk charmeuse dress and a single opera-length strand of cultured pearls, sat on a cushioned wicker chair by the French doors with her trusty Thai ladies' maids standing solemnly behind her, while three of her middle-aged children stood in a row before her like school kids waiting to turn in their homework. Felicity and Victoria watched as their brother Philip ceremoniously offered the little teacup to his mother with both hands and formally offered wishes of good health and prosperity. After Su Yi took a sip of the oolong tea infused with dried red dates, it was Eleanor's turn. As Eleanor began pouring the steaming liquid from the ornately carved Qing dragon teapot, the first guest of the morning could be heard arriving.
Hiya! Those tans come earlier and earlier every year, Felicity said irritatedly.
Victoria shook her head in disapproval.
That Geraldine is always worried that she'll miss out on the food. She gets fatter and fatter every year.
I'm scared to imagine what her triglyceride level must be.
Now didn't that good-for-nothing Eric Tan just marry some Indonesian girl? I wonder how dark she's going to be, Felicity said.
She's Indonesian Chinese. Her mother is one of the Lim sisters, so I bet you she'll be fairer than all of us put together. Now don't say a thing. But Cassandra warned me that Auntie Lillian May just got back from America and is sporting a new wig.
She thinks it makes her look younger,
but Cassandra thinks she looks like a Pontiana, Victoria muttered.
A female ghost with long rat-nest-like hair that lives in a banana tree. From Indonesia and Malay mythology, Pontianaks are said to be spirits of women who died while giving birth. A Pontianak kills her victims by digging into their stomachs with her sharp, dirty fingernails and devouring their organs. Yum.
Goodness gracious, Facility giggled. Just then, Lillian May breezed into the room, followed by a retinue of sons and daughters, assorted spouses, and grandchildren. The matriarch of the Tan family approached Su Yi, bowed ever so slightly, and offered the traditional New Year greeting.
Gong hei fa choy.
Congratulations and wishing you prosperity. The proper greeting in Cantonese. Naughtier children prefer to say, Happy New Year, I pull your ear. Or gong hei fa choy, ang pao de lai. Now give me that ang pao.
Gong hei fa choy. And who are you?
Su Yi asked, peering at her through her trademark tinted bifocals. Lillian May looked taken aback.
Suyi, it's me, Lillian May Tan.
Suyi paused for a moment before saying completely deadpan,
"Oh, I didn't recognize you with your new hairstyle. I thought that wicked English woman from Dynasty had come to visit me."
Lillian didn't know whether to be pleased or offended, but everyone else in the room broke out in laughter. Soon, more members of the extended Yang, Sen, Shang clan began to arrive, and everyone rushed around gong hei fa choying the hell out of each other, handing ang baos to the kids, complimenting one another's outfits, commenting on who had put on weight or looked too skinny, trading reports on whose house just sold for how much, showing off pictures of their most recent holiday, grandchild, medical procedure, and stuffing their faces with pineapple tarts. As guests began dispersing toward the grand staircase and the upstairs drawing room, Lillian May took the opportunity to greet Eleanor.
"I didn't want to compliment you in front of Felicity and Victoria, who are always so jealous of you. But I must say your purple wrap dress is a winner. You are by far the most elegant woman in the room."
Eleanor smiled graciously. "You look lovely too. That's quite an outfit.
Is the kaftan detachable?"
"I got this when I was visiting my sister in San Francisco. It's this marvelous new designer I discovered. What was the name? Let me think. Eddie Fisher. No, that's not right. Eileen Fisher. Now, the West Coast has really had an unseasonably cold winter. You really must pack some extra warm clothing for your trip."
"My trip?" Eleanor furrowed her brow.
"To California."
"I'm not going to California."
"But surely you and Philip are going to..."
Lillian began, before suddenly breaking off. "To what?"
"Dear me, I'm such a fool. I'm sorry, I confused you with someone else for a moment,"
Lillian sputtered.
"Kick those, say."
"Cantonese for, this irritates me to death."
"I'm getting so senile. Oh, look, Astrid and Michael are here. Doesn't Astrid look divine? And little Cassian looks so adorable in that bow tie. I must go and pinch that cutie pie's cheeks."
Eleanor's jaws tightened. This Lillian May was such a bad liar. Something was up in California, and Eleanor's mind reeled at all the possibilities. Why would she and Philip ever go to godforsaken California together? Unless there was some big event involving Nikki. Was he finally getting married?
Yes. Yes. That must be what was happening.
Of course, the one person who would know the truth was Astrid, who at this very minute was standing at the staircase landing while Lillian May, rather bizarrely, stroked her dress. From afar, Astrid appeared to be wearing a rather simple white shift with blue detailing on the sleeves and hemline, but as Eleanor got closer, she realized that the blue detailing was actually silk embroidery that mimicked Delft China patterns.
"Aiya, Astrid, every year I come here just to see what couture dress you'll be wearing, and you certainly didn't disappoint. You are by far the most elegant woman in the room. Who are you wearing? Is it Balmain? Chanel? Dior?"
Lillian May gushed. "Oh, this is just a little experiment that my friend June whipped up for me," Astrid said. June Takahashi, the creative force behind the cult fashion label Undercover. The prototype of Astrid's dress was quite possibly the inspiration for his autumn-winter 2014 collection.
"It's absolutely divine! And Michael, from Topayo to Tycoon! My son tells me you have become the Steve Gates of Singapore."
"Ha ha. No la, auntie,"
Michael responded, too polite to correct the old lady.
"It's true. Every time I open Business Times, I see your face."
"Do you have a hot tip for me?"
Eleanor asked as she joined the group.
"Auntie L, from what my friends at GK Go tell me, you're the one who could give me a few stock tips."
Michael laughed, clearly enjoying this new adoration from his wife's relatives.
"Rubbish la. I'm just a small fry compared to you.
Excuse me, but I need to borrow your wife for a minute, Eleanor said, grabbing hold of Estrid's elbow and steering her down the long gallery-like drawing room to the corner by the grand piano. The young pianist, who looked like he was barely out of his first year at the Raffles Music College, as he sweated profusely in his suit, was playing some innocuous Chopin etude. Estrid knew from the force of her grip that Eleanor meant business. Talking over the music, Eleanor said,
I want you to tell me the truth. Is Nikki getting married in California?
Estrid took a deep breath.
Yes.
And when is this happening?
I don't want to lie to you, but I specifically promised Nikki I would not give out any details, so you'll have to ask him yourself.
You know as well as I do that my son has refused to take my calls for over 2 years.
Well, that's between you and him. Please don't put me in the middle of this.
You are in the middle of this whether you like it or not, because you two have been keeping secrets.
Eleanor was fuming. Estrid sighed. She hated confrontations like this. Given the circumstances, I think you know exactly why I can't tell you.
Come on, I have a right to know.
Yes, but you have no right to sabotage his wedding.
I'm not going to sabotage anything. You have to tell me. I'm his mother, damn it.
Eleanor exploded, forgetting where she was. The shocked pianist stopped playing, and suddenly all eyes in the room were on them. Estrid could see that even her grandmother was peering over in their direction with displeasure. Estrid pursed her lips, refusing to say anything. Eleanor looked at her sharply.
This is unbelievable.
No, what's unbelievable is how you can expect Nikki to want you anywhere near his wedding, Estrid said, her voice shaking, before she stalked off. 3 weeks before the new year, the chefs from the Yang, Shang, and Xian households would gather at Tyersall Park's cavernous kitchen to begin the marathon production of New Year delicacies. Marcus Sim, the Shang family's acclaimed pastry chef, based at their estate in England, would fly in to prepare all manner of non-year desserts. Rainbow-hued kueh lapis, delicately sculpted ang ku kueh, and of course, his famous kueh bangkit cookies with Makona almonds. Alien, the Xian's longtime cook, would supervise the team responsible for the labor-intensive preparation of pineapple tarts, sinfully sweet nian kao, and savory chai tau kueh, radish cakes. And Ah Ching, the chef at Tyersall Park, would oversee the New Year's Day luncheon where a gigantic baked ham, with her famous pineapple brandy sauce, would make its annual appearance. But for the first time in as many years as she could remember, Eleanor did not enjoy her lunch. She hardly touched any of the ham that Geraldine Tan proclaimed to be even juicier than last year's, and she couldn't even face her favorite nian kao. She loved the way the sticky rice flour dessert cake was prepared here. Cut into half-moon slices, dipped in egg batter, and fried to a golden brown so that the outer layer of the cake was light and crisp, yet sweet and gooey the minute you bit into it. But today, she just didn't have the appetite for anything. Following strict seating protocol, she was trapped next to Bishop Sibei Xian, and she glared at her husband on the other side of the table, who was tucking into another helping of ham as he chatted with the bishop's wife. How could he eat at a time like this? An hour ago, she had asked Philip whether he had heard anything regarding Nikki and a wedding, and he had shocked her by saying, Of course.
What? Why didn't you tell me la?
There was nothing to tell. I knew we weren't going to go.
What do you mean? Tell me everything,
Eleanor demanded. Nikki called me in Sydney and asked me if I wanted to come to his wedding. I asked if you were invited, and he said no. So I told him, Good luck, chap, but I won't be coming if your mother doesn't, Philip calmly explained.
Where is the wedding? When is it?
I don't know.
Alamak! How can you not know when he invited you?
Philip sighed. I didn't think to ask. It wasn't relevant since we weren't going.
Why didn't you tell me about the conversation in the first place? Because I knew you were going to be unreasonable about it?
You are a moron, an absolute moron,
Eleanor screeched. See, I knew you were going to be unreasonable. Eleanor played with her braised noodles, seething on the inside as she pretended to listen to the bishop complain about some pastor's wife who was spending millions trying to become a famous pop star. At the children's table, Cassian's au pair was trying to coax him into finishing his lunch.
I don't want noodles. I want ice cream,
the boy fussed.
It's Chinese New Year. No ice cream for you today, his au pair said firmly.
Suddenly, an idea came to Eleanor. She whispered to one of the serving maids.
Can you please tell Ah Ching that I have a sore throat from all this heaty food, and I'm desperately craving some ice cream?
Ice cream, ma'am?
Yes. Any flavor, anything you might have in the kitchen. But don't bring it to me here.
I'll meet you in the library. 15 minutes later, after having paid off Cassian's au pair with 5 crisp $100 bills, Eleanor was sitting at the black lacquered scholar's table in the library, watching the little boy devour an ice cream sundae out of a large silver bowl.
Cassian,
when your mummy is away, you just tell Ludovine to call me, and my driver will come and pick you up and take you for ice cream any time you like, Eleanor said.
Really?
Cassian said, wide-eyed.
Absolutely. It will be our little secret.
When is your mother going away? Did she tell you she's getting on an aeroplane and going to America soon?
Uh-huh. In March.
Did she tell you where she was going? Is she going to Cupertino? Or San Francisco? Los Angeles? Disneyland?
L.A.,
Cassian said, while gulping down another spoonful. Eleanor breathed a sigh of relief. Marge gave her enough time. She patted the boy on the head and smiled as he stained the entire front of his bon pois dress shirt with hot fudge.
Serves Astrid right for trying to keep things from me.
Chapter 6. Morton Street, New York. February 10th, 2013, 18:38 p.m. PST. Text messages to Nicholas Young's private cell phone, the one his parents don't have the number for. Astrid.
Your mum found out about the wedding. Happy New Year.
Nick. WTF. How did she find out?
Astrid.
Not sure who leaked. She confronted me at our mass. Things got ugly.
Nick.
Really?
Astrid.
Yes. She went nuts and made a scene when I wouldn't give her any details.
Nick.
So she doesn't know when, where, etc.
Astrid.
No. But I'm sure she'll find out eventually. Get ready.
Nick.
I'll double down on security at the venue. We'll hire ex-Mossad.
Astrid.
Make sure they're all from Tel Aviv, with good tans, lots of stubble, and great abs.
Nick.
No, we need really sinister guards. Maybe I should call Putin and see whom he can recommend.
Astrid.
Miss you. Gotta run. Ling Chie's ringing the lunch gong.
Nick.
Please wish Ling Chie gong hei fa choy and save me some chai tau kui.
Astrid.
I'll save you all the crispy bits.
Nick.
My favorite. February 10, 2013, 9:47 a.m. EST. Message left on Nicholas Young's voicemail in New York.
Nikia, are you there? Happy New Year! Are you celebrating in New York?
I hope you are going to do something. If you cannot find Yi Sang in Chinatown, at least have a plate of noodles. We have been at Ama's all day. Everyone was there. All your cousins. Eric Tan's new Indonesian wife is very pretty and has very white skin. I think she must bleach it.
I heard they had a ridiculously lavish wedding like Colin and Araminta's, but in Jakarta. Her side paid for most of it, of course. I'm sure her side will pay for all of Eric's money-losing films from now on. Nikki, please call me when you get this message. There's something I need to discuss with you. February 11th, 2013, 8.02 a.m. EST. Message left on Nicholas Young's voicemail in New York.
Nikki? Are you there?
Alamak, this is getting ridiculous. You cannot keep ignoring me like this.
Please call me back. I have something very important to tell you. Something you will want to know. I promise. Please call me as soon as possible.
February 12, 2013, 11.02 a.m. EST. Message left on Nicholas Young's voicemail in New York.
Nikki, is that you? Nikki?
He's not in. Dad here. Please call your mother. She needs to speak to you urgently. I want you to put aside your feelings and just call her. It's Chinese New Year. Please be a good son and call home. It was Rachel who heard the messages first. They had just arrived home from California, and after setting the luggage down, Nick had run out to grab some sandwiches at La Panineria, while Rachel unpacked and checked the voicemails on the home line. They were out of mortadella, so I got a prosciutto and fontina with fig mustard and a mozzarella, tomato, and pesto panini. I thought we could share both, Nick announced upon returning to the apartment. Handing the paper sack to Rachel, he sensed that something was off.
You okay?
You need to listen to the voicemails, Rachel said, handing him the cordless phone. While Nick listened, Rachel went into the kitchen and began unwrapping the sandwiches. She noticed that her fingers were trembling, and she found herself unable to decide whether to leave the sandwiches on the wax paper or put them on plates. For a moment, she became angry with herself. She hadn't thought that hearing Eleanor Young's voice again after all this time would have this effect on her. What was it she was feeling? Anxiety? Dread? She wasn't quite sure. Entering the kitchen, Nick said, "You know, I think that's the first time in my life my dad's ever left me a voicemail. I'm always the one who calls him. My mum must be giving him hell."
"Looks like the cat's out of the bag,"
Rachel forced a smile, trying to mask her nerves. Nick grimaced.
"Astrid sent a text warning me while we were at your uncle's, but I didn't want to mention anything while we were all celebrating New Year's. Things were tense enough with all the talk about your father. I should have known this was coming."
"What do you think you'll do?"
"Absolutely nothing."
"You're really going to ignore her calls?"
"Of course. I'm not going to play her game."
Rachel felt relieved at first, but then a little conflicted about whether this was the right way for Nick to handle things. Ignoring his mother had gotten them into all that trouble the first time around. Was he making a big mistake again?
"Are you sure you don't want to at least speak to your father? Maybe try to clear the air before the wedding?"
Nick thought about it for a moment. "You know, there's really nothing to clear. My dad already gave us his blessing when I spoke to him last month. He's happy for us. At least."
"But what if the messages have nothing to do with our wedding?"
"Listen, if there was anything truly important my parents needed to tell me, they would have just told me on the voicemail. Or Astrid would have told me. This is just some new scheme my mother has cooked up in a last-ditch effort to prevent us from marrying. I gotta hand it to her. She's like a rabid dog that just won't let go of your leg," Nick said, fuming.
Rachel walked into the living room and sank down onto the sofa. Here she was, a girl who had grown up never knowing her father. As much as she detested Eleanor Young, She couldn't help but feel sad that Nick had become so estranged from his mother. She knew it wasn't her fault, but she hated that she was part of why it happened. She gathered her thoughts for a few minutes before finally speaking. I wish things didn't have to be this way. I never thought I'd ever put you in a position like this. You didn't put me in any position. This was my mother's own doing. She only has herself to blame. I just never imagined I'd be at a place where my future husband's parents weren't invited to our wedding, and most of his family won't be there. Nick took a seat beside Rachel. We talked about this already. It's going to be fine. Astrid and Alistair will be there, and they are my closest cousins. You know I've always hated those traditional Chinese weddings where everyone and their cat is invited. We're going to have an intimate ceremony surrounded by your family and our closest friends. Just you, me, and our chosen family. No one else matters.
Are you sure?
I'm more than sure, Nick said as he began to kiss the tender spot at the nape of her neck. Sighing softly, Rachel closed her eyes and hoped he really meant what he said. A couple of weeks later, the students enrolled at New York University in the course Britain Between the Wars, The Lost Generation, Rediscovered, Deconstructed, and Restored were treated to the most curious spectacle. In the middle of Professor Young's lecture, two extremely tan, extremely blonde women of Amazonian proportions entered the classroom, dressed in identical outfits of figure-hugging navy blue cashmere sweaters, immaculately pressed white linen slacks, and white nautical caps with gold piping on the brims. The pair sauntered up to the front of the classroom and addressed the professor.
Mr. Young, the favor of your presence has been requested. If you would please come with us, one of the blondes said in a thick Norwegian accent.
Not sure what to make of this, Nick replied. My class isn't over for another 25 minutes. If you'd care to wait outside, we can speak when it's over.
I'm afraid that's not possible, Mr. Young. The matter is extremely urgent, and we've been requested to collect you immediately.
Immediately?
Yes, immediately,
the other blonde replied. This one had an Afrikaans accent that made her sound much sterner than the Norwegian.
Please, come with us now.
Nick was starting to get a little annoyed by the disruption when suddenly it hit him. This had to be some pre-wedding prank, most likely courtesy of his best friend Colin Koo. He had assured Colin that he didn't care for a bachelor party or any sort of fuss. But it sure looked like these two leggy blondes were part of some elaborate ploy.
And what if I don't go with you? He said with a playful grin.
Then you will give us no choice but to resort to extreme measures, the Norwegian replied.
Nick found himself fighting to keep a straight face. He hoped these women were not about to bust out a boombox and start stripping. His classroom would descend into total chaos, and he would lose control of these already attention-deficient kids, not to mention all his hard-earned credibility, since he hardly looked older than most of his students.
Give me a few minutes to wrap things up, Nick finally said.
Very well. The women nodded in unison. 10 minutes later, Nick exited the classroom as his students excitedly whipped out their phones and began texting, tweeting, and Instagramming pictures of their instructor being led away by two statuesque blondes in nautical-inspired outfits. Waiting in front of the building on University Place was a silver BMW SUV with tinted windows. Nick got in a little reluctantly, and as the sedan began speeding across Houston Street and onto the West Side Highway, he wondered where in the world he was being taken. At 52nd Street, the car merged into one of the exit lanes leading towards the Manhattan Cruise Terminal, where the cruise ships that visited New York all docked. Moored at Pier 88 was a superyacht that looked like it had at least 5 levels of decks. The Odin, it was called.
Good God, Colin has way too much time and money on his hands, Nick thought.
Staring up at the gargantuan vessel
which seemed to sparkle as shards of sunlight reflecting off the water danced across its midnight blue hull. He climbed up the gangway and entered the grand foyer of the yacht, a soaring atrium with a circular glass elevator in the middle that looked like it could have been stolen from an Apple store. The blondes escorted Nick into the lift, which rose just one floor before opening up again.
"We could have taken the stairs," Nick remarked wryly to the ladies.
He stepped out of the elevator, half expecting to find the room filled with friends like Colin Koo, Mehmet Sabanche, and some of his cousins. But instead, found himself alone on what seemed to be the main deck of the yacht. The ladies led him through a series of sumptuous spaces, past sleek lounges paneled in golden sycamore, barstools upholstered in whale foreskin, and a salon with a ceiling that glowed like a James Turrell installation.
Nick began to have the sinking feeling that none of this had anything to do with a bachelor party.
Just as he was beginning to consider his options for a hasty exit, they arrived at a pair of sliding doors guarded by two tall, strapping deckhands.
Oh, so blonde, most likely Swedish.
The men slid the doors apart, revealing a skylit dining deck. At the end of the deck, lounging on a dining settee in a white PK blazer, white jodhpurs, and camel-colored Fili Fabri riding boots, was none other than Jacqueline Ling.
"Ah, Nikki, just in time for the souffle," she said.
Nick approached his old family friend, feeling equally amused and exasperated. He should have clued in earlier that all the Scandinavian silliness had something to do with Jacqueline, whose longtime partner was the Norwegian billionaire Victor Norman.
"What kind of souffle is it?" Nick asked nonchalantly, taking a seat across from the legendary beauty dubbed the Chinese Catherine Deneuve by the society pages.
"I believe it's kale and Emmentaler. Don't you think all the sudden hype about kale is getting a bit much? I want to know who's been doing all the PR for the kale industry. They should really get an award. Now, aren't you the least bit surprised to see me?"
"Actually, I'm rather disappointed. For a while I thought I'd been kidnapped and forced to be an extra in a James Bond movie."
"Didn't you enjoy meeting Alana and Mette Marit? I knew you wouldn't come if I had just called up and invited you to lunch."
"Of course I would have, but at a more normal time. I hope you're going to find me a new job when NYU fires me for abandoning my class in the middle of a lecture."
"Hiya, don't be such a spoil sport. You have no idea how hard it was to find a place to dock this beast.
Now, I thought New York was supposed to be such a world-class city. But do you know your biggest marina can only hold up to 180 feet? Where is anyone supposed to park their yacht?"
"Well, this is quite a beast. Lursen, I presume."
"Fincantieri, actually. Victor did not want his baby built anywhere near Norway, with those pesky journalists always scrutinizing his every move. So he chose an Italian shipyard instead. Of course, Espen designed this one, like he has all our other boats."
She's naturally referring to Espen Oino, one of the world's leading naval architects, who has designed super yachts for the likes of Paul Allen, the Emir of Qatar, and the Sultan of Oman.
"Auntie Jacqueline, I don't think you summoned me here to talk about shipbuilding. Why don't you say what you really came to say?"
Nick said, breaking off a corner of a still warm baguette and dipping it into his souffle.
"Nicky, I told you never to call me auntie. You make me feel like I'm past my cell date," Jacqueline said in mock horror as she flicked a lustrous lock of black hair behind her shoulders.
"Jacqueline, you don't need me to tell you that you don't look a day over 40, Nick said.
39, Nicky.
"Okay, 39, Nick laughed.
He had to admit that even as she sat across from him in the bright sunlight with only a touch of makeup on, she was still one of the most stunningly attractive women he had ever known.
There's that handsome smile of yours. For a while I was afraid you were beginning to get surly. Don't ever get surly, Nikki. It's most unbecoming. My son Teddy always has the most surly, supercilious look about him. I should never have sent him to Eton. I don't think Eton had anything to do with it, Nick offered. You're probably right. He has those snobby, recessive limb genes from my late husband's side. Now, you should know that all of Singapore was talking about you over the Chinese New Year. I highly doubt that all of Singapore was talking about me, Jacqueline. I haven't lived there in over a decade, and I really don't know many people. You know what I mean. I hope you don't mind my being frank. I've always been very fond of you, so I don't want to see you do the wrong thing. And what's the wrong thing? Marrying Rachel Chu. Nick rolled his eyes in frustration. I really don't want to be drawn into a discussion about this with you. It would be a waste of your time. Ignoring him, Jacqueline continued. I saw your ama last week. She summoned me to visit her, and we had tea on her veranda. She is very distressed by your estrangement from her, but at this point, she is still willing to forgive you. Forgive me? Oh, that's rich. I see you're still reluctant to see her side of things. I'm not reluctant at all. I can't even begin to see her side of things. I don't know why my grandmother can't be happy for me, why she cannot trust me to make a decision about who I want to spend the rest of my life with. It has nothing to do with trust. Then what is it about? It's a matter of respect, Nikki. Your ama cares for you dearly, and she has always had your best interests at heart. She knows what is best for you, and only asks that you respect her wishes. I used to respect my grandmother, but I'm sorry. I can't respect her snobbery. I'm not going to roll over and marry into one of the five families in Asia deemed acceptable by her. Jacqueline sighed and shook her head slowly. There is so much you don't know about your grandmother, about your own family. Well, why don't you tell me? Let's not keep it a mystery. Listen, there is only so much I can say, but I will tell you this. If you choose to go through with your wedding next month, I can assure you that your grandmother will take necessary measures. Meaning what? Meaning she's going to cut me out of her will. I thought she did that already, Nick said mockingly. Forgive me if I sound patronizing, but the arrogance of youth has led you astray. I don't think you truly realize what it means for the gates of Tyersal Park to be closed to you forever. Nick laughed. Jacqueline, you sound like some character out of a Trollope novel. Laugh all you want. But you're being rather foolhardy about this. There is this sense of entitlement that was bred into you, and you are letting that affect your decisions. Do you really know what it means to be cut off from your fortune? I'm doing just fine. Jacqueline gave Nick a patronizing smile. I'm not talking about the 20 or 30 million your grandfather left you. That's just ditto, lui.
Hokkien. For play money.
You can't even buy a proper house in Singapore with that these days.
I'm talking about your real legacy. Tyersal Park. Are you prepared to lose it?
Tyersal Park is going to be left to my father, and one day it will pass to me, Nick said matter-of-factly. Let me give you some news. Your father long ago gave up any hope of inheriting Tyersal Park. That's just idle gossip. No, it's not, Nikki. It's a fact. And aside from your grandmother's lawyers and your great-uncle Alfred, I am probably the only person on the planet who knows this. Nikki shook his head in disbelief. Jacqueline sighed. You think you know everything. Do you know I was with your grandmother the day your father announced that he was going to immigrate to Australia? No, because you were away at boarding school during that time.
Your grandmother was furious at your father. And then she was broken-hearted. Imagine, a woman of her generation, a widow, having to suffer the indignity of this. I remember she cried to me. What's the use of having this house and all these things when my only son is abandoning me? That's when she decided to change her will and leave the house to you. She skipped over your father and put all her hopes in you. Nick couldn't mask his look of surprise. For years, his busybody relatives had engaged in covert speculation over the contents of his grandmother's will. But this was one twist he hadn't imagined. Of course, your recent actions have sabotaged those plans. I have it on good authority that your grandmother is preparing to change her will again. How will you feel if Tyersall Park goes to one of your cousins?
If Astrid gets it, I'd be happy for her.
You know how your grandmother is. She will want the house to go to one of the boys. It won't go to any of the Leongs because she knows that they already have too many properties. But it could very well go to one of your Thai cousins or one of the Chings. How would you feel if Eddie Ching became Lord and Master of Tyersall Park? Nick looked at Jacqueline in alarm. Jacqueline paused for a moment, carefully considering what she wanted to say next. Do you know anything about my family, Nicky? What do you mean? I know your grandfather was Ling Ying Chao. In the 1900s, my grandfather was the richest man in Southeast Asia, revered by all. His house on Mount Sophia was bigger than Tyersall Park, and I was born in that house. I grew up much like your family did, in a kind of luxury that hardly exists today. Wait a minute. You're not going to tell me that your family lost all their money. Of course not, but my grandfather had too many damn wives and too many children, so the fortune's been dispersed. Collectively, we'd still rank high on the Forbes list, but not when there are so many of us feeding from the pot these days. But look at me. I'm a girl. My grandfather was an old-fashioned man from Amoy, and for people like him, girls weren't supposed to inherit. They were just married off. Before he died, he put all his holdings in the Labyrinthine family trust, stipulating that only males born with the Ling surname could benefit. I was expected to marry well, and I did. But then my husband died much too young, and I was left with two small children and some titolui. Do you know how it feels to live among some of the richest people in the world and feel like you have nothing compared to them? Take it from me, Nicky. You have no idea what it's like to come from everything and then lose it all. You're not exactly hurting, Nick gestured at their surroundings. True, I've managed to maintain certain standards, but it has not happened with the sort of ease that you might imagine. I appreciate your story, but the difference between you and me is that I don't require all that much. I don't need a yacht or a plane or a huge estate. I spent half my life in houses that were far too big, and it's such a relief to live the way I do in New York. I'm perfectly content with my life just the way it is. I think you misunderstand me. How can I put it to you more clearly? Jacqueline pursed her lips for a moment and considered her finely painted manicure, as if she wasn't quite sure what she wanted to say. You know, I grew up thinking that I was born into a certain world. My whole identity was wrapped up in the notion that I belonged to this family, that I was a Ling. But the moment I got married, I found out that I was not considered a Ling anymore. Not in the truest sense. All my brothers, half-brothers, and idiot male cousins would inherit hundreds of millions each from the Ling Trust. But I wouldn't be entitled to a cent. But then I realized, it wasn't really the loss of money that was affecting me the most. It was the loss of the privilege. To suddenly realize that you are inconsequential even within your own family. If you go through with this marriage, I promise you will feel a seismic shift. You can act self-righteous in front of me right now, but believe me, when it is all taken away, you won't know what hit you. Doors that have been open to you all your life will suddenly be closed, because in everyone's eyes, you are nothing without Tyersal Park. And I would hate to see that happen. You are the rightful heir. How much is that land worth today? 60 of the most prime acres in the heart of Singapore. It's like owning Central Park in New York. I can't even begin to fathom the value. If Rachel only knew what you were giving up. Well, I'm certainly not interested in having any of it if I can't share my life with her, Nick said adamantly. Who said you couldn't be with Rachel? Why don't you live with her as you have been? Just don't get married now. Don't rub it in your grandma's face. Go home and make peace with her. She is in her 90s. How many years does she have left? After she goes, you can do anything you want. Nick considered her words in silence. There was a gentle knock on the door, and a steward bearing a tray of coffee and desserts entered. Thank you, Sven. Now try some of this chocolate cake. I think you'll find it to be quite interesting. Nick took a bite, recognizing immediately that it tasted exactly like the airy yet rich chocolate chiffon cake made by the cook at his grandmother's house. How did you manage to pry the recipe out of Ah Ching? He asked in surprise. I didn't. I smuggled a slice into my handbag when I had lunch with your grandmother last week and had it flown straight to Marius, the genius chef we have aboard. He spent 3 days doing his own forensics on the cake, and after about 20 attempts, we got it just right. Don't you think? It's perfect. Now, how would you feel if you could never have this chocolate cake again? I'll just have to be invited back to your yacht. This isn't my yacht, Nikki. None of this is mine. And don't think I'm not reminded of this every day of my life. Chapter 7 Belmont Road, Singapore, March 1st, 2013. The man with the machine gun tapped on the tinted glass of Carol Tai's Bentley Arnage.
Lower your window, please, he said gruffly.
As the window came down, the man peered in, carefully scrutinizing Carol and Eleanor Young in the back seats.
Your invitations, please, he said, extending a Kevlar-gloved hand.
Carol handed over the engraved metal cards.
Please have your handbags open and ready for inspection when you get to the entrance, the man instructed, gesturing for Carol's chauffeur to drive on.
They passed through the security roadblock, only to find themselves bumper to bumper with other fancy sedans trying to make their way toward the house with the red lacquered front door on Belmont Road.
Aya, if I knew it was going to be this late, Che, Hokkien for troublesome. I wouldn't have come, Carol complained. I told you it wouldn't be worth the headache. It never used to be like this, Eleanor said, glaring at the traffic jam and thinking back to the earlier days of Mrs. Singh's jewelry tea party. Gayatri Singh, the youngest daughter of a Maharaja, possessed one of Singapore's legendary jewelry collections, set to rival that of Mrs. Lee Yong Chen or Shang Su Yi. Every year, she would return from her annual trip to India with another stash of heirlooms, spirited away from her increasingly senile mother, and starting in the early 1960s, she had begun inviting her dearest friends, women hailing from Singapore's elite families, to come over for tea to celebrate her latest baubles. Back when Mr. Singh was running the show, it was such a relaxed affair. It was just a bunch of nice ladies in beautiful saris sitting around the living room. Everyone took turns fondling Mrs. Singh's jewels, while gossiping and gobbling down Indian sweets, Eleanor recalled.
Carol scrutinized the long queue trying to get through the front door.
This looks anything but relaxed. Alama, who are all these women all dressed up like they're going to a cocktail party?
It's all the new people. The who is who of Singapore society that no one has ever heard of.
Mainly Chindos.
Crazy rich Chinese plus Indonesia equals Chindos.
Eleanor sniffed.
Ever since Mrs. Singh lost interest in counting her carrots and began spending more time in India studying Vedic scriptures, her daughter-in-law Sarita, a former minor Bollywood actress, had taken over the affair, and the Homey Ladies Tea Party evolved into a high-profile charity exhibition to raise money for whatever happened to be Sarita's cause du jour. The event was breathlessly chronicled by all the glossy magazines, and anyone who could pay the exorbitant entry fee had the privilege of traipsing through the Singh's elegant modernist bungalow and gawking at the jewelry, which nowadays consisted of some specially themed exhibition. This year's show was devoted to the works of the acclaimed Norwegian silversmith Tone Vigeland. And as Lorena Lim, Nadine Shaw, and Daisy Fu peered into the glass vitrines in what was now the gallery, converted from the former table tennis room, Nadine could not help but register her dismay.
Alamak, who wants to see all this Scandinavian kausai?
Hokkien for dog shit.
I thought we would get to see some of Mrs. Singh's jewels.
Keep your voice down. That Ang Mo over there is the curator.
Red hair in Hokkien. This is a slang term used to refer to Caucasians of all stripes, even though the majority of Caucasians don't have red hair or stripes.
Apparently, she is some hot shot from the Austin Cooper Design Museum in New York,
Lorena warned.
I don't care if she's Anderson Cooper. Who wants to pay $500 a ticket to see jewelry made of rusty nails? I came to see rubies the size of rambutans.
Nadine has a point. This is such a waste of money, even though we got these free tickets from my banker at OCBC, Daisy said.
Just then, Eleanor entered the gallery, squinting at the bright lights. She immediately put her sunglasses back on.
Eleanor? Lorena said in surprise. I didn't know you were coming to this.
I wasn't planning to, but Carol was given tickets by her banker at UOB, and she convinced me to come. She needs cheering up.
Where is she?
In the toilet, of course. You know her weak bladder.
Well, there's nothing here that will cheer her up unless she wants to see jewelry that will give her tetanus, Daisy reported.
I told Carol this would be a waste of time. Sarita Singh only wants to impress her arty-farty international friends these days. 3 years ago, she invited me, Felicity, and Astrid, and it was all this Victorian mourning jewelry. Nothing but black jet and brooches made from the hair of dead people. Hak Seiyan!
Although this Cantonese phrase means scares people to death, it is used to describe anything that's gross or creepy.
Only Astrid could appreciate it. Let me tell you what I'm appreciating right now. Your new Birkin bag. I never thought you'd be caught dead with one of these. Didn't you once say that only tacky mainlanders carried such bags? Nadine asked.
Funny you should say that. This was a gift from Bao Xiaoyan.
Wow. Ani ho mia.
Hokkien for, you have such a good life.
I told you the bows were loaded, Daisy said. Well, you were right. The bows are loaded beyond belief. My God, the way I've seen them spend in just a few months they've been here. Nadine, if you thought your Francesca was a spendthrift, you should see how that Carlton spends. I have never seen a boy more obsessed with cars in my life. At first, his mother swore she would never let him set foot in another sports car. But every time I go over there, there's some exotic new car in their sky garage. Apparently, he's been buying cars and shipping them back to China. He claims he'll make a fat profit reselling them to his friends.
Well, it sounds like Carlton has made quite a recovery, Lorena said.
Yes, he hardly even needs his crutches anymore. Oh, in case you were still thinking of him for your Tiffany, you should stop. Apparently, he's already got a girlfriend. A fashion model or something like that. She lives in Shanghai, but flies down to see him every weekend.
Carlton is so handsome and charming. Of course there must be a long line of girls trying to catch him,
Nadine said. He may be all that, but I can see now why Xiaoyan loses sleep over her son. She told me that the past few months have been the most relaxed time she's had in years. She's afraid that once Carlton is fully back on his feet again and they return to China, he will be impossible to manage.
Lowering her voice, Lorena asked,
Speaking of China, did you meet with Mr. Wong?
Of course. That Mr. Wong has put on so much weight. I think the private investigating business must be Jin Ho Sing Li.
Hokkien for a very profitable business.
So everything is good? Did you read the dossier? Did I ever? You won't believe what I found out about the Baos, Eleanor said with a little smile.
What?
Lorena asked, leaning in closer. Just then, Carol entered the gallery and made a beeline for Lorena and Eleanor.
Alamak! There was such a long line for the bathroom. How's the show?
Daisy took her by the arm and said, I think there were more interesting things to see in the Jambun than in this show.
Malay, for toilet.
Come, let's see if the food is any better. I hope they have some spicy samosas.
As the ladies made their way down the passageway toward the dining room, an Indian woman with snow-white hair, wearing a simple bone-colored sari, emerged from one of the rooms and caught sight of them.
Eleanor Young? Is that you looking so mysterious behind those sunglasses?
The woman asked in an elegant, lilting voice.
Eleanor took off her sunglasses.
Ah, Mrs. Singh, I didn't realize you were back in town.
Yes, I'm just hiding from the crowd. Tell me, how is Sui? I missed her Chap Goh Me party the other night.
Hokkien, for 15th night, a celebration held on the 15th day of the first lunar month to mark the official end of New Year's celebrations. On this evening, single ladies will cast oranges in the river under the full moon in the hopes of finding good husbands while everyone else in Singapore starts planning their diets.
She's very well. Good. I've been meaning to pay her a visit since I got back from Cooch Behar, but I've been so jet-lagged this time. And how is Nikki? Did he return for New Year's?
Not this year, no, Eleanor said, forcing a smile. Mrs. Singh gave her a knowing look.
Well, I'm sure he'll be back next year. Yes, of course, Eleanor said, as she proceeded to introduce the ladies.
Mrs. Singh nodded graciously at everyone.
Tell me, are you all enjoying my daughter-in-law's exhibition?
It's very interesting, Daisy offered.
To be honest, I much prefer when you used to show your own jewelry, Eleanor ventured.
Come with me,
Mrs. Singh said with a mischievous smile. She led the women up a back staircase and down another passageway lined with Mughal-era portraits of various Indian royals in antique gilt frames. Soon, they came upon an ornate doorway inlaid with turquoise and mother-of-pearl, guarded by a pair of Indian police officers.
Don't tell Sarita, but I decided to have a little party of my own, she said, flinging the door open.
Inside was Mrs. Singh's private sitting room, an airy space opening onto a luxuriant veranda lined with lime trees. A butler was handing out steaming cups of chai, while a sitar player plucked a soft, entrancing melody in a corner. Several ladies in iridescent saris sprawled on the deep purple divans, nibbling on sweet ladoos, while others sat cross-legged on the cashmere silk carpet, admiring the rows upon rows of jewels blindingly arrayed on large forest green velvet trays in the middle of the floor. It felt like being at a pajama party inside the vault of Harry Winston. Daisy's and Nadine's jaws dropped, and even Lorena, whose family owned an international chain